Epilogue. I shall always be grateful to the many members who made my return to the house very much easier than it might have been, by their immediate greetings and friendly attitude. Many, I fear, whose actions in the chamber itself and outside were detected or reported to the press representatives, found themselves the victims of a vendetta inside their constituencies and in the press on that specific account. When we reflect upon these bloody happenings from the time of King Charles I to our own day, we can at long last find only one cause for satisfaction, if such a word can be in any way appropriate. It is that for the first time we can now trace the underlying influences, which explain these hideous disfigurations in European history. In the light of present-day knowledge, we can now recognize and understand the true significance of these terrible happenings. Instead of mere disconnected occurrences, we can now discern the merciless working of a satanic plan. And seeing and understanding, we are in a position to take steps in the future to safeguard all those values which we love and stand for, and which that plan clearly seeks to destroy. We can at last begin to oppose the planners and operators of that plan, knowing about it and their technique, which till now have been known to them alone. In other words, being forewarned, it is our fault if we are not forearmed. Let us not forget such words as those of the Jew Marcus Eli Ravage, who wrote in the Century Magazine USA in January 1928, "We have stood back of, not only the last war, but all your wars, and not only the Russian, but all of your revolutions worthy of mention in your history." Nor should we forget those of Professor Harold Laski, writing in the New Statesman and Nation on 11th January, 1942, "For this war is in its essence merely an immense revolution in which the war of 1914, the Russian Revolution, and the counter-revolutions on the continent are earlier phases." Nor the warning from that eminent Jewish-American attorney, publisher and reporter, Henry Klein, issued only last year, "The Protocols is the plan by which a handful of Jews, who composed the Sanhedrin, aim to rule the world by first destroying Christian civilization." Not only are the Protocols genuine, in my opinion, but they have been almost entirely fulfilled. They have indeed been largely fulfilled, no small measure of Jewish thanks being due to Mr. Roosevelt and his ardent lieutenant, the self-styled architect of the Jewish future. In the process, however, Britain and her empire and, worse still, her good name and honor have been brought down to the dust. As Professor Beard wrote, "The noble principles of the Four Freedoms and the Atlantic Charter were for practical purposes discarded in the settlements which accompanied the progress and followed the conclusion of the war." In the validity of this statement, the treatment of the people of Estonia, Lithuania, Poland, Romania, Yugoslavia, China, Indochina, Indonesia, Italy, Germany and other places of the earth bear witness. There appeared recently in the press the cry of Mrs. Chiang Kai-shek calling Britain a moral weakling in reference to China. She is reported as saying, "Britain has bartered the soul of a nation for a few pieces of silver. One day these pieces of silver will bear interest in British blood, toil, sweat and tears on the battleground of freedom." It might be General Sikorsky himself speaking, might it not? In the same paper I saw that Mr. Jackson Martin Dell, president of the American Institute of Management, has declared that an Englishman's word is no longer his bond. How often have I heard this from Arab sources since 1939? Mr. Martin Dell continued, "I hate to say this, but Britain is becoming poor morally as well as economically." From Poland to Palestine and to China, these words are re-echoed, and be it said, reiterated by the Jew-wise section of this country for many years. The reason is not far to seek. No man can serve two masters, more especially when the principles and interests of these two masters are as widely divergent as are those of Britain and her empire, and Jewry and their empire, the USSR. Ever since the fall of Mr. Chamberlain's government, the interests of the Jewish empire have been advanced as prodigiously as those of Britain and her empire have been eclipsed. Stranger than all this, should any dare to state the truth in plain terms, the only response is an accusation of anti-Semitism. As Mr. Douglas Reed has clearly shown, the term anti-Semitism is meaningless rubbish, and as he suggests, it might as well be called anti-Semolina. The Arabs are Semites, and no so-called anti-Semite is anti-Arab. It is not even correct to say that he is anti-Jew. On the contrary, he knows better than the uninformed that a fair proportion of Jews are not engaged in this conspiracy. The only correct term for the miscalled anti-Semitic is Jew-wise. It is indeed the only fair and honest term. The phrase anti-Semite is merely a propaganda word used to stampede the unthinking public into dismissing the whole subject from their minds without examination. So long as that is tolerated, these evils will not only continue, but grow worse. The Jew-wise know that we have in Britain a Jewish imperium in imperio, which, in spite of all protestations and camouflage, is Jewish first and foremost, and in complete unison with the remainder of world Jewry. If any doubt this, they need only read Unity in Dispersion, issued in 1948 by the World Jewish Congress, which proclaims Jewry to be one nation. Not all Jews here wish to be railroaded into this narrow social tyranny, but unless this country affords them some way of escape, they dare not take the risks, very grave risks, of defying it, and so they perforce cooperate to some degree. Even worse, certain Gentiles with no good excuse support this united force, which is in turn used to influence or control our political parties, home and foreign policies, press and public life. This unholy united front must be exposed and frustrated. One step towards this objective would seem to be firstly an enactment to prevent Gentile Esau's from lending their hands for the carrying out of orders uttered by the voice of Jewish Jacobs. Another, detachment from the Jewish United Front of Jews, who do not wish to subscribe to the dictates of the World Jewish Congress. First and foremost, however, is the need to inform people of goodwill as to the truth of this matter, particularly in regard to the real anatomy, aims, and methods of the Marxist enemy. It is to that end that I humbly offer the contents of this book to all who are determined to fight communism.